This episode of Screen Divers was recorded right before the passing of Julian McMahon. He will be truly remembered through the various memorable roles he played throughout his life. Our hearts go to his family and his friends. Julian, the Screen Divers salute you. Enjoy the show. This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about The Surfer, released in 2024 at the Cannes Film Festival, and it received a global release later on in 2025. This movie is directed by Lorcan Finnegan, written by Thomas Martin, and starring Nicolas Cage, Julian McMahon, Nick Cassim, Miranda Tapsell, Alexander Bertrand, Justin Wroczniak, Fahal Roman, Charlotte Maggi, and a lot of other unknown actors that maybe we will see again in the near future. Cinematography by Radek Laszek, edited by Tony Cranston, music by Francois Tétart, produced by Saturn Films, Arena Media Lovely Productions, T-Shop Productions. It is distributed by Madman Film Stand in Australia and by Vertigo Releasing in Ireland and the United Kingdom. You can go out of your way or not go out of your way to find where this movie is streaming. You'll decide that at the end of this. Or perhaps you've seen it already, but the movie's out there and you can get it. It has a running time of 100 minutes. This movie is a co-production between Australia and Ireland, and it was made for $2.1 million. How are you guys?
I'm really good. This was an interesting choice of a movie. I have to say that. Yeah.
There's not much out about this movie at the moment because, it just did a film festival circuit and it's only been out on the cinemas for about, half a month in May?
I picked this movie solely on the basis that anyone else would apply to watch this movie, which is that Nicolas Cage is in it. And from the trailer, it looks like Nicolas Cage would do what Nicolas Cage does. If this was an investment, I would have made quite a bit of money because there's a fuck ton of crazy in this movie. There's a lot of cool stuff to talk about. There's a new Mortal Kombat finishing move in this, which is called Pocket Rat, which I adored. There's another contender for a movie that would make you feel heat. Lived in Australia for almost, 1.5 decades, and I can tell you this movie did something really well, and that is to convey the unforgiving Australian summer. It's when it gets hot, it gets really hot, and you'll actually feel it through the screen.
Ricky, do you want to add to that? Because you're currently living in Australia.
I live on the East Coast, and it gets a variety of warmer, wetter all the time. It's not as far as Queensland, which is pretty much tropical. When it gets hot over here, you don't want to do anything. You don't want to even go anywhere near a beach. You actually just want to go to a shop or the cinema and just stay very cool.
Yeah, and the only way that you could justify involving yourself into some kind of standoff in the middle of the summer, in the middle of Christmas, which is the hottest point of summer. Mm. And this is a point made at the beginning of the movie. One of the surfers, the very guy that goes, "Don't heave here, don't surf here." That guy.
I think you'll find it. Don't live here, don't surf here.
With his little Christmas hat.
Are we
on.
All going to butcher it? Are we all going to fucking do this?
Yeah, we might as well.
Don't live here, don't surf here.
Hey, you don't live here, you don't surf here.
Why does it sound like Alec Guinness is wearing a fucking wetsuit, dude?
You don't live here.
You don't surf here. These aren't the breaks you're looking for.
Oh, my God.
Holy shit, man.
That's funny.
Ricky, what's this movie about?
Picture a man, he's going to a beach, it's his hometown, but it's not his hometown anymore. And it's a bunch of people who don't want him there. And they constantly say, you don't live here, over and over again. And then finally, he gets a little bit disturbed, to say the least. And then madness ensues. This is The Surfer 2024.
Nice. You looked slightly pained saying that, though. Oh.
Because I really wanted to say, don't live here, don't park here, don't live here, don't have coffee here, don't live here, don't get charges here on your phone, don't live here, don't eat rats here. You know, I wanted to just, you know, keep that going for a while.
Yeah. I got to tell you,
$100 pizza.
Jesus. $100 pizza, man. Holy shit.
Which ends up on the floor.
Yeah, and you feel it. You feel that. That's enough to spiral. You know what I mean? Like, but he goes, it's, you know, there's a vein of falling down running through this a little bit as well.
I was going to touch on that. I really wanted to say this movie, when I started watching it, felt like it was going to turn into Falling Down. And it was just going to go full on break shit at the end. You know?
Look, this time around, I didn't watch a movie with Steve. It was me and Anne. And Steve and Mari watched it together at their place as well. And I was glad they came around yesterday. They dropped by very briefly. And I was glad that the reaction was an interesting one. It's what you would want from a movie, regardless of the movie being flawed or not. And that is for the movie to be memorable. Because one of the things that Mari uttered is the way we all felt. Steve's partner was in my kitchen and she goes, I can't stop thinking about it. I'm like, exactly. And that's because the movie is kind of flawed in some points and it paints us really, really strangely. And there's a lot of misdirection in this film as well, which we will discuss. I also asked a couple of questions yesterday to them when they were here. And the principal one, which I'm curious, Ricky, did you watch a movie with Sally?
Yes, I did. Yeah,
excellent. Good. Because I'm asking that question because there was an affinity in the way we reacted to the movie. All right. So that's, I guess that's the mark of a good movie because it means that it's intentionally trying to spur some kind of emotion. And if it hits the mark with everybody, that means that it's doing it really well, particularly in a movie that's full of obstructions like this one. And just in the previous episode, which to our listeners, if you didn't go and listen to it, please go listen to it. It's one of our most serious episodes, perhaps, because the content, you know, we're talking about The Conversation, which is a masterpiece, but I think it was Ricky said something about the unreliable narrator, which is what we get here. And it's more justified here because he becomes the protagonist of this movie, which, by the way, we never know his name. You don't need to know his name. He's credited as The Surfer, and that's all you need to know about him. And the fact that we don't know his name works for the movie, actually. It's essential that we don't know his name because at some point the movie will require you to suspend this belief and that's when you're ready to walk away. And if you don't, you'll get paid. I mean, that's what it did to me at least. But what I'm trying to touch on here is there's one sequence where the surfer, played by Nicolas Cage, is on the phone to his ex-wife. And when he's on the phone to his ex-wife, there is a 30-second part of the conversation that would inevitably lead to something that you will utter yourself at the screen with your partner when it happens.
Yep.
She's about to tell him something, and before she tells him something, we all, myself and Anne, and apparently Steve and Mari as well, I turned around to Anne and we both together said it, I'm pregnant. Like that's what she's going to say to him. Ricky, did you experience the same thing? Did you guys say it out loud?
I'm afraid we didn't because I don't know what it was about some of the conversations on the phone that Nicolas Cage was having. But this is a film where, as Umbar was leading up to it, it is very much an unreliable narrator. However, there's a lot of purposeful confusion in this film. And so every time they were, and I think it's mine and Sally's fault. Mine and Sally and I, when we watch films, we go into deep analysis mode. You might as well have the Charlie Day board behind us at all times, because we are literally going, this string matches here, and oh, did you see that? Oh, they're going to bring that back, and oh, and this is it, and when you talk to this, and then the milkman is going to come in, and yeah, so
Pepe Silva.
Exactly.
This name keeps coming up over and over again every day. Pepe's mail's getting sent back to me. Pepe Silvia. I look in the mail, well, this whole box is Pepe Silvia. So I say to myself, I gotta find this guy, I gotta go up to his office, I gotta put his mail in the guy's goddamn hands, otherwise he's never gonna get it.
So whenever we hear these conversations, whenever we were hearing these conversations that he was having on the phone, I was actually more interested in the conversations he was having with work. And I don't know if you guys felt that.
I was as well, because I was trying to place it. It's like, what is it? Why am I telling? Why are they telling me that you walked into the boardroom, you know,
with no shoes on?
Your shoes and socks, I think they say, something like that. Or
they're worried about you. We need to have a 9 a.m.
I was
meeting.
Trying to place it's that like, in the narrative, because there is a point where he's shoeless, but there's also the only time, unless I'm mistaken here, that you see him leave the parking lot is the first drive off, is when he takes his kid away. So you'll think that he would resume his workday. And also, it's hard to track how much time he's spending in this parking lot. What is believable is how it spirals into, you know, a touch of madness here. He goes crazy. And the idea is, I believe it. I believe it because you could easily, due to dehydration, man, I said it at the beginning of this podcast, I remember when I moved to Australia in 1990, end of 96, beginning of 97, whatever it was. Do you come from a land down under? A women go and men wonder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover. I moved to Glen Waverley. It was the middle of the summer. Glen Waverley is a suburb in Victoria. Before I, you know, then I moved to other places in Australia, and I'll touch on that because I actually moved to a place akin to, well, Yallingup, which is where this is shot. It's Luna Bay doesn't exist. It's fictional, but it's also based on something else in California. We'll talk about that. But I lived for 8 months when I moved from Victoria to New South Wales. I lived in Ocean Grove. Ocean Grove is right next to Torquay, and that is one of the stops for the World Championship, the Windsurfing World Championship. Yeah. I almost got murdered. I almost got killed by territorial surfers.
Yeah.
And it happened during a confrontation. I'll tell the story later if you guys want to hear it. But anyway, going back to... So I believe that even like a 48-hour period already could get you to spiral. But it's hard to... At least I know that at least... Tell me if I'm wrong, but at least he spends two or three nights sleeping in this area.
So and it's supposed to be 3 days.
3 days, there you go. Yeah. So yeah, believe it or not, people that think, oh, but you wouldn't go crazy. Fuck, you would. You would. If it was 44 degrees Celsius and you couldn't go into the water and you couldn't drink and you couldn't eat, you would go fucking mental. You would lose your mind, because the level of dehydration would speed up the process of denutrition. It would speed up the decline of your cognitive ability in general, and then you'll go crazy. So
I've got a question for you guys, which is... unlike the conversation is meant to be a film set in the real world. Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you think any part of this film is set as a real story, or do you think it's all a very heavy metaphor?
It places itself in both categories, purely on the basis that this deals with toxic masculinity. It's also the fact this is set over Christmas, and there's a lot of heavy religious visualizations in this. Iconography. We're looking at the seven disciples. We're looking at the red that is worn. When we look at red is both used for Jesus and the devil. We've got that side of it as well, where we've got that grinding of somebody in a sense of they're all out to get him. He doesn't realize this, but they're doing it deliberately. And that's something which we're going to go through with this entire thing. But I think living or coming from South Wales, there's a certain amount of territorialism when we go to certain areas where, for instance, I couldn't go to other parts near my area because I was seen as living from the posh side.
Yep.
So I couldn't go to the rough section without getting punched, basically. And kind of the vice versa situation. So this, I think that some ideas have been taken from real world situations and then placed into a super narrative.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How about you, Umbar?
I have to mirror what Steve said, because he's correct. I mean, surfers are territorial, but they are localists. It's one of those tribalistic behaviors that gets carried on and gets almost exasperated by a remote location, simply because due to lack of infrastructure or older stupid traditions or whatever, you know. I'm not going to say that it's backwards, right? It's and even among surfers, it's one of those practices that it's kind of criticized. But the more remote you are, the more it's likely to happen. Mm. It's dangerous, but it's also there's two camps of kind of schools of thoughts about it. One of them could be associated with you don't live here, you don't surf here because it's dangerous, and that's fair enough. And this is Australia, which is hostile. Like I can tell you that. You know, you get used to it when you live there, but the water anywhere, any coastline, it's a constant reminder of the elements working against, you know, a human being, basically. So ideally for you to just visit and surf there, you could be at risk of injury very easily. So that's one camp. But the other one is, this is not your place. This is ours. You know what I mean? We claim this. And that's tribalism 101, which, by the way, Nicolas Cage, what's the name of the guy that plays Scully? McMahon.
Julian McMahon.
He's fantastic in this.
He's really good.
He's fantastic in this. And he's the antagonist,
yeah.
All right, as much as Nicolas Cage is, because that's another point to be made. Both of them are. And like Steve said earlier, the setting, the hostility of the setting, and also the message of this movie about toxic masculinity, you could argue that Scully is an amalgamation of Andrew Tate and fucking Jordan Peterson, and in this age of, you know, a young generation that doesn't have, that, you know, that it's basically on a rudderless trajectory without some kind of, because obviously, you know, religion has lost grounds. So hence where the religious kind of approach of a, it's almost cult-like, but yet again, this isn't fucking fiction, man. It is, but it's very close to what's happening in the real world. And if you had nefarious intent, you could easily just take the reins and just get a bunch of people to follow you because they have nothing else.
Yeah.
So this is exactly what it's like. I'll tell the story now very briefly. Yeah. I'll just go through it very briefly. When I was living in Ocean Grove, first of all, I've got a thick accent now, but I had a thicker accent then, right? I moved there with my girlfriend at the time, who was Australian, and some of you guys may know this or may not, but I can actually sing, all right? Because I used to front the band years ago. And we went to, you know, I was in my early 20s, so, you know, I carried myself around possibly in an irritating manner as well. So, and this is a territorial joint. I didn't think about any of this. I just moved there. We go to this pub. There was a karaoke competition. I win it, right? And then, as we're having the free drinks, which was part of the whatever the price was for winning this thing, in this little pub in the middle of the night, middle of nowhere, which, by the way, it's a pub, I can't remember the name, that is famous because one of the first times that, what was the name of the original singer from AC/DC? Bon Scott.
Oh, Bon Scott. Yeah, Bon Scott.
Yeah, one of the first times that he almost died, he died in the parking lot of this pub, almost. He didn't die there, but And the confrontation started in the actual part that the marked where his car was parked when he almost choked on his own vomit the first time around. Anyway, we're at the bar. This fucking dude with dreads walks past my girlfriend at the time, slaps her ass, and I see it. And blood went to my head very quickly. But instead of losing my shit, because she comes up to me, she goes, oh, you know, she looked distraught by the entire thing. And I thought, okay, just don't fucking lose your shit right away. I walked to this guy and I went, hey, man, do you want to go and apologize to her? And he goes, apologize for what, mate? And he goes, well, you just slapped her ass, didn't you? She's on a piece of meat. You want to go apologize? Nah, mate, I'm not doing that. And he starts walking out. And I could have left it there, and I didn't. He started walking out, but not from the front door. He started walking out from the back door that led into the parking lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking as soon as I cross. So he's like 10 meters in front of me. As soon as I cross the threshold of the exit, I can see like another six people as dark figures in this dark, coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Coming out of nowhere. He's in front. And I start hearing, what are you doing, Matt? What are you doing? And they're all wearing fucking dreads. Like, it's that kind of thing. All surface. All I remember is that I can feel my face is wet, but I've gone into fucking Logan mode because I was crazy. So I can feel, I'm not feeling pain, but I'm being punched in every possible way. But I also feel the grip of my hand on his dreads.
Yeah.
And I'm not letting his head go. Mm-hmm. So I'm being kicked and punched and I'm not letting his fucking head go. And the bouncer behind me is trying to pull me back into the pub with all this. So as soon as he pulls me in, this guy scatter, okay? I go to the bathroom, spit on the mirror, and then wipe the mirror, and I can see the reflection of the bouncer behind me going, you're fucking crazy, mate. And it doesn't end there. We leave, and I remember that we left. The moment we left, there was a car chasing us all the way home.
Mm-hmm.
24-hour pass. I was working in the first place allowed to serve alcohol for 100 years in Usher Grove. It was like a little bar, cocktail bar, whatever. The dude walks in.
Yeah.
The dude walks in. He walks all the way up to me after they almost murdered me. Puts his hand, sticks his hand out, and he goes, you all right, mate? Nice to meet you last night.
Yeah.
Never had a problem again.
Ever again. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, you know what? Hilariously, as much as... Right, so one of my big problems with this film is the... And I know it's meant to be. It's meant to be a little bit of Aussie exploitation. It is.
Yes, yeah.
Definitely. Even, come on, look at the talent sequences. Yeah. It looks like 70s Grindhouse, right? That's what they did.
But it's also... So there is rumour that actually this film... was inspired by one of my favorite films with Burt Lancaster, The Swimmer. So it has that aesthetic as well.
Yeah.
You know. But this is one of my sticking points with this film, is that it's kind of doing the same thing that Wolf Creek did.
Well, I'm doing people a service. I'm taking out a few roofs. They're everywhere out here now. Like tourists.
That quite a few of those Aussie exploitation films have done in the past 20 years, where it's like, you don't want to come here,
you know. Hey, do it again, man. That's a good soundbite. Do it again.
You don't want to come here. You don't want to do here. Oi, what are you doing here?
Mate.
What are you looking at? Mate. And then...
Head on a stick.
But it's funny how you... put across that story, because that's what I've found. Like, I work in a what is considered a rural part of Australia. It's not really, because it's only half an hour from the city, but it's considered rural. People consider my area quite rough. I live in a very nice suburb at the moment, but the thing...
Are you going out of your way not to mention any of these places?
Yeah, exactly. Just in case. But
just record your fucking full address.
Yeah.
After the tune we put at the end of the
season. But where I work is a rural area, and there's a lot of that, you know, home and away-esque drama, Heartbreak High-style drama going on all the time in where I work. But you're right. As soon as they know your face, as soon as they know who you are, and as soon as they know why you're here, everyone's so nice. You know, they might be rude. They might be talking to you
it's trial by fire.
Yeah,
you know that's what it is.
As soon as they know you're going to stick around, they're like, "Ah, come on over. Oh, come and have a drink. Oh, you're teaching my kid. He's a little shit, isn't he? But you know, come and have a drink. Yeah, you know, it's funny how a lot of these Australian films trying to use a very broad brush to like paint a lot of Australia. When actually it is actually quite a multicultural, diverse country here. And at the end of the day, all they care about is, are you messing around with my turf? Are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? And the minute you're like, no, I'm just here to do X, Y, and Z, they're like, oh, come on over, come have a drink. Oh, you must be thirsty, mate. It's pretty hot out there, and all of that stuff. And it's just funny because like when I watched this film, I couldn't help but go, oh, this is a bit like a Wolf Creek, or oh, this is a bit like, oh, they're really trying to make out that Australia's so out there and so different. It's so far away and so different, and everybody's a bit, because all the culturalism, all the masculinity stuff, I see it more in American kids. I see it more in British kids, you know, especially British kids. I love Britain. I grew up in Britain, but that sort of masculinity, I've seen more in England than I have seen out here.
True. Yeah. However, you could argue that, I mean, this is the experience that I have with Australian culture. It is an amalgamation of Americanisms and, you know, the residual kind of presence of the British Empire. So it kind of took its own identity. And there's no place like it. And I do get it. I do get that the representation in fiction in particular, it's like, you know, from around here, mate. Mm. Like, imagine if, because most of Australia isn't fucking livable, dude.
Mm.
People don't realize, like, there's a lot of fucking desert in the center. It's a hostile kind of place. But on the outskirts, there's a ton of tourism, and you get a ton of younger people that are just passing through. So, yes, I get this, because after a while, it would get tiring, dude. It would get tiring to deal with, I dare to say it, outsiders.
Mm.
So that trial by fire, that kind of clash, initial clash, and then it's like, okay, you're one of us. That's being Australian. I think that's what that is. So it takes time, okay? And yes, because there's a lot of remote locations in Australia as well, there is also the possibility of, you know, backward thinking. But that happens everywhere. The moment you start moving away from central infrastructure, like capital cities or whatever, not just in Australia, anywhere in the world, that's where, you know, the educational system is a bit of a letdown. That's where, so minds get smaller.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think when it comes to Australian film, because another film that was coming to mind was The Royal Hotel. If you saw that psychological thriller by Kitty Green, which was based on a documentary called Hotel Coolgardie. That had two American backpackers going to a hotel out in rural wherever because they'd run out of money and that was the best way they could get money to get out. But again, it was all of that, like, they turn up and they're all like, oh, you know, come in and see the new oddies who are serving the beer and all that, you know. And it's that sort of masculinity culture that
Absolutely. They
put on Australia a lot. Whereas I would
but
say...
But this movie doesn't do that, though. It really doesn't put too much on Australia. I think it's the reason why you have, you know, that where they shot at that parking lot is actually where that beach is,
Yellingup,
which is a remote area. And I like that.
Yeah.
I kind of like the fact that besides, you know, the Australian accent in this movie, it's not denouncing anything because there's nothing to denounce. If anything, Australia is very progressive, dude. Very progressive.
But I was going to say, what's the difference between when you put Australia on the map with these sort of films where you're trying to point out that there is a lot of tribalism and there's a lot of othering. The difference is that when you've got somewhere like the UK, you know, the class system in the UK is that everybody lives next to each other. Like, it's funny how when you look at the UK now, especially cities of the UK, you've got one block of nice flats, you've got one block of council flats, and they are the same block, basically.
Yeah.
And you have that mixture. Whereas with Australia, you have that affordability. You'd said it's a huge, huge country. You have that affordability where people can tribalize. People can stick absolutely. To one area and all of that stuff. Yeah.
Look, I really, and I know that that's not where you're going. So let's try and put it under. Let's try and focus in on what I think we agree on. I think the only thing that gives an Australian flavor to this movie is, you know, it's just it's the jargon use, maybe it's that kind of thing. But I don't think that it really is focusing on that. I think what it's doing, and perhaps it's important that we, you know, shine a light on this. I think it's focusing on the concept that Steve mentioned earlier, which is toxic masculinity and the rise of, you know, schools of thoughts that are regressive ultimately, but they are taking hold because when you take something else away, you need to replace it with something. Mm. And this gives rise to that loud minority you were talking about earlier, right? And in this case, it's really toxic.
It's also the loudest, which, you know, will always come to the top.
Prevail, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the weakest as well.
Yeah.
Because these people turn out to be the opposite of what masculinity should be about. But that's a different story.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you can grab a hold of a weak mind, but for how long? That's the question, you know, that needs to be answered. But in this instance, I think, and I like the fact that, if you look a little deeper than just watching the credits roll in this movie, even the name given to the Bay Boys here, which is the setting is Luna Bay. Now, what the director went out of their way to do, I assume, was to kind of use the basis of real life for a tale that kind of has, that is grounded. Because the execution is taking you to, you know, an hallucinatory world, you know, like it's there's this psychedelics and everything that goes with surfer culture as well. So this movie is actually a rare beast, man. Like I said earlier, I was ready to walk away, and regardless of how flawed it is, it's memorable, and I'm glad that we watched it, and I'm glad that I peaked it, and But yet again, that culture that is criticizing the very concept and these boys, that's something that happened in California.
Mm.
Yeah,
it is.
You know what I mean? So if anything, the only focus on the setting here, for example, after living in Australia, there's a couple of little things that you pick up on that it's denouncing, you know, the sociopolitical phase that a country is going through, particularly with young people as well. And I'll clarify this for our viewers that haven't lived in Australia. There is an epidemic in Australia that has been going on for 20 years and it just got worse. When it comes down to recreational drugs, there's a real problem in Australia. And that is, you know, if you are experimenting when you're younger, you kind of work your way through certain, you know, party ailments or whatever. Now there's an entire generation that actually doesn't go through the steps and jumps right into something that is the equivalent of crack, which is called ice in Australia. Mm. That's methamphetamine. Mm. In this movie, you will see a shot of our protagonist, the surfer, waking up. And as he opens his eyes, you will see that next to him, there's something that is either being planted where he fell asleep or where he passed out, or it's something that these Bay Boys are indulging in with younger girls, by the way, which is bad.
Yeah.
That is not a crack pipe. That is a device that is a glass pipe that is used to smoke ice. Now, it's just hinted, and I bet you that a lot of that stuff ended up on the cutting floor because there are other bits where the Bay Boys are actually dealing in the parking spot as well.
There's an actual reference straight away in the first 5 minutes of the movie where they turn around and says, it's Christmas and it's been snowing down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, it's straight in there.
Man, I love the fact that the guy that utters the mantra of this movie, which is "Don't leave here, don't surf here."
Yeah,
he's the bank manager.
Yeah, I'm the bank manager. But you
don't
know,
worry about that, mate.
You know, Steve, through all your research, did you find out about the inception of this film that the writer went through, like what he witnessed?
So I didn't. It doesn't actually state in any of the interviews that I watched exactly what he witnessed.
Okay, I'll start with that then, because the writer, Thomas Martin, was in Australia, and he was in Australia selling a film or at a premiere or a film festival of a film. And while he was sitting in a cafe, he saw two people surfing come onto the beach and put on clothes and look like they were about to, you know, go to their banking office or whatever. But then they started having a discussion, a very heated one, and then they started beating on each other to the point where some of them, they lost like a couple of teeth each. And that was the inception of this film for him. He was like, I guess they have an office job, but on top of that, they're going to go to their office job now without a few more teeth, and everyone's just going to be like, yeah, that's what they do at lunchtime. Hey.
So basically, the director and writer met at a film festival, and they got talking, and they ended up going for drinks, and both being Irish and everything else, and they kind of like disappeared off, went back to Ireland, and they suddenly realized after communicating on the phone, they only live 30 yards from each other. But they never met in Dublin. Mm. So they became quite firm friends. And over the years through that film festival meeting, they'd always kind of talked about doing a movie together. And this was refutation of that meeting. And it's 10 years later.
I gotta say, again, regardless of what you think of this movie, perfect casting.
There was one other person that was kind of hinted at as possible being the only other name that they could other, not Nicolas Cage. And I was somebody who was in a certain movie called Moon.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Remember who it is?
Yeah, Sam Rockwell. Sam Rockwell would have done this well as well.
Yeah. That was the only other name which came
up. But then again, Sam Rockwell can do everything. So I'm a huge fan. So, but Nicolas Cage spiraled here really well. And also his character, the surfer, he's the product of trauma. Yeah. He has never dealt with his father's suicide in this. There are so many moments that really doesn't matter. Like, again, like I said earlier, I was ready to walk away when this movie was imposing this demand upon me as a viewer, which was, you need to suspend this belief now. You do it now, you do it again and again and again. And then, after a while, you realize, if you accept it, you realize that it doesn't matter. It should, because it was detracting from the movie at one point. Because you can't just, you can use misdirection, and that's where the confusing nature of this movie comes into play. It's as Ricky mentioned earlier. I don't think of it, ever exercised a level of acceptance to this extent with a movie, so that's an achievement within itself already, because it's allowed. Like, once you play, you start understanding the rules of this movie, then you can play by them, but a lot of people would be ready to walk away.
Man, I'm just going to say this. I did walk away, like, multiple times in this movie, because I found it a hard watch in some respects. I would pick up the dishes and or cups and take them into the kitchen and walk back while still listening to what was going on, because like I was like, oh, this is tough, like this is an actual hard watch. And
in what, like, in what way though? Like,
I think it was the toxic masculinity side of it. Like it was a little bit over the top, and I think
it was. But for me, it was more like, why would you subject yourself to this?
Yeah.
Why would you subject yourself to this extent? Mm-hmm. But in order to accept that, I think you need to deal with the fact that this guy is, you know, the recipient of heavily seated trauma that he's never dealt with. Hence why this all of a sudden becomes a crusade that, you know, and he's in the midst of it. You need the scene. You need the scene, the breaking scene where his wife tells him, because he's trying to achieve all these things to hold on to the past, to be the father he didn't have for his son, and then you need the breaking point. If anything, actually, I think Nicolas Cage held back a little at the beginning of this movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, like,
because full force.
Yeah, because he's trying to retain his sanity as much as possible, even when we get to meet the bum. And there's this blurring the lines between, is he there? Is he not there? Is he a figment? And at times he is, and it doesn't matter. For the movie to get to the point of going, really, it doesn't matter, because it is a parable for almost like it's like you said, and I use the word parable now. The movie, again, is rife with symbolisms, and they're all religious. Yeah. There's the sequences that are very cleverly placed in this, like when he goes to the public toilet and he leaves his jacket and his shoes unattended, and they're taken away. Then the bum all of a sudden resembles the silhouette of his father. He was wearing a suit. He was found with a suit when he died. So there's these little things, you know what I mean? Like there's the separation of him and the memento of his watch that was given to him by his father. And then there's the parallel of something else that was passed from father to son with the bum, which is the shark tooth.
Yeah.
There's all these little things. And I like the omission of the name of the main character as well, because until the name of the son is uttered in this movie without, not orally, it's not dialogue, but it's a newspaper cutout.
Yeah.
We see that the son's name is Jay, right? Even the surface kid, like son in this, is not mentioned. He's referred to in the credits as well as the kid.
Hmm.
You know, you need that ambiguity about who he is, because it's not really about him, but it is about the tale itself. And it's strange because we're introduced to the protagonist's past as well. So,
well, this is my, okay, so as I said earlier, Sally and I kind of do the whole Charlie Day thing and all of that stuff. To an extent that as soon as we saw the bum, and you see the bum within about 10, 15 minutes, I think Sally turned around to me and said, "What's the bet that the surf is the bum?" And I was like, this was 15, 20 minutes into the movie, right?
That's what Anna said as well.
And this is, I think, what is interesting, one of my initial questions on this podcast was, how much of this do you think is real and how much of this do you think is a huge metaphor? I would personally say this whole thing's a metaphor, because from the start of the film, there's this whole monologue that Nicolas Cage has about talking about waves and what waves mean and how you associate them with life. And from that moment, that's what he's doing. He's battling waves. He's battling the to and fro, the ebb and flow of life. And it's all a metaphor to an extent that I feel personally that none of it, when you see Scully with his family, there's a point where Nicolas Cage's character is sitting in the car. He's getting sunstroke and all that stuff. He looks out and he sees Scully with all of his family, like his kids, his wife, and they're all going down to the beach to
the luau, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're all, it's the shift from their life to their secret life.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I think
that shit happens, man.
Yeah,
but that shit is real.
But I think because they went down and had their like family life, and then he was like staring at them through the goggles. I think that was the real Scully, if you know what I mean. And everything else was like his own persona, his id, his ego battling with himself. But that's, you know, again, that's like the psychology Ricky, like like going through his Freudian books and his Jung books and being like, oh, I can tell you that the superego in this scene and all that stuff.
But it's just the fact that it's called Sanctuary as well is a huge kind of metaphor in itself.
And it's supposedly his surfboard that is Sanctuary.
Sanctuary,
Which has been there for 7 years as well. Started doing the Pepe Silva thing that you were doing as well. Like, where are we in a timeline here? Did this happen 7 years ago and now is the bum? Like, I was doing all of that as well. And I'm sure that you did those mental gymnastics, because that's exactly what this movie will get you to do, right?
Yeah.
I was on a treadmill at one point. But any other movie, I wouldn't have done that. Fuck going to the gym here. But for this one, I'll do my 45 minutes to... Yeah, that's my training regimen, by the way. Regimen. My training
regimen.
My training regimen.
So,
which ends with a croissant. My training regimen. Which, by the way, him being denied the pastry by that prick, I was really upset. I thought, come on, man, just give him the pastry with the flatty. I love the terminology as well. I'm a coffee man, you know that, right? Yeah. It's just the reference to the flat white being the flatty. It kind of brought praise to coffee culture in Australia, because that means you can get a good coffee anywhere, even in a parking lot. And that's true.
That's
you guys
true.
To our listeners that haven't been to Australia, That is the most reasonable part of this movie. You can get a fantastic cup of coffee, even in a fucking parking lot, yeah. In the middle of nowhere in Australia.
There's the odd McDonald's out here where it's like, oh, their coffee can't be that good. It actually is okay. It's fine, you know, for a quick fix.
But you think you have good coffee, you wait until you go to Australia.
But then we get the next scene. Which is where Pitbull basically pushes the coffee over him. I just went, oh, no.
Oh, dude. But the dog shit on the fountain. You know, I realized later that it's that Shaza, by the way. Shaza. These are all names of people that live in rural Australia. Right? Mm-hmm. Those endearing nicknames. The fact that she brings a cigarette to her mouth with the same hand when she's holding the dog shit.
Yeah.
It's like Kath and Kim, but like the horror version of it.
she utters something.
She's good in this.
She utters something that is so what we've been talking about the masculine.
They gotta blow out some steam.
Our boys will be boys. You know, another thing that makes this film that slightly like, this is all going on in his head, because these people, they do exist and people do say that, but it's that rhetoric that keeps this sort of culture going. You were going to say, though.
Credit goes to Radek here, Lachak, and I hope this guy goes far. Maybe he's gone far already and I'm blissfully ignorant to his work. He's used a wide-angle lens in this at the right time. And when things get quirky here, they get quirky, but in a negative way. Like, they get quirky,
I'm just going to highlight this because I know a little bit about this. This film is only shot on two cameras. And it's basically a wide-angle camera.
Lens.
And a lens.
Say that again.
It's shot on a wide-angle lens, and it's also shot on a close-up.
Mm.
That's it. There's only
there
two
are
camera-
some fucking Sergio Leone homages here. Man.
Yeah,
like you get because especially it's a standoff. With the heat. There's a lot of this movie that feels like a Western as well. It really does. Like it's also battling against odds. So our protagonist here is at fault as well. That's why Scully kind of gets an even ground with him. It's not just a true and true villain. That's the problem with this. And the movie needs to do this because otherwise it doesn't denounce the very field in which this current war of society is battling at the moment with all this, the rising kind of ideology that it's toxic. That's what it is, right? This toxic masculinity cults. You need to have him charming. You need to put him on some kind of level so that it justifies why some people go for this shit. About Julian McMahon as an actor, I gotta tell you, I didn't realize a bunch of stuff. He's a very good actor, dude. He's a phenomenal actor. And you piece of shit, you stole that from me. He was Dr. Doom. Yes, he played Dr. Doom. Mm-hmm. Yes, because I looked at his entire career as well. And actually, was a saving point for that movie.
Yeah.
Because his performance was
great.
Did any of you watch Nip Tuck?
No, I didn't.
Where he plays the surgeon, right?
Yeah.
He plays the surgeon in it. Yeah,
and it's all plastic surgery. It's a phenomenal TV series.
Yes.
And he does so good in that.
Did you know, I looked at factoids about his past. Did you know that he's the son of an Australian Prime Minister?
I knew he was Australian. I didn't know he was the son of a prime minister.
He's the son of a prime minister, and he's the son of one of the longest serving members of parliament in Australian history.
No.
His role as prime minister was very short lived. It was like a year.
Wow.
Yeah, and he died when he was only like fucking. That's another reason why maybe he dipped into something personal for this.
Yeah,
because usually you'll find he died, like his father, the father of the actor that plays Scully, died when he was only like 4 months old or some shit like that. So, and that's a perfect recipient for the toxic masculinity kind of ideology, you know, like because you get people following these schools of thought or whatever the fuck you would call like figures when there's no guidance.
Exactly, and that's it. He is a replacement father figure for Arthur.
Yeah.
Going back to Radek Ludchuk, he is the same cinematographer or DOP who is used by Jennifer Kent, who is the director and writer of The Babadook and The Nightingale as well.
Yeah.
I've actually got to say that in this film, I will praise maybe 5 or 6 actors in this film, but I really didn't like the background actors. No. I didn't feel them. That's maybe honest, the boys.
I agree with you, but you know the guy that looked like Shyamalan?
Yeah. Oh,
Rahul Rahman.
What's the name of the director? How do you pronounce the name of the director?
Let's not Sixth do Sense this and... now. Let's not try.
Wait a second. No. Shyamalan. There's something about it. It's got to be the same ethnic background, but he looked a little bit like him. And I thought, is that? Did they fucking get him in this movie? I hope they did.
Did they spend $1.5 million just on M. Night?
Can I tell you that there was like a very amateurish kind of... I think they did that on purpose.
Yeah.
But it's the entire thing about when he's confronting the dude. I love that sequence. That was one of my favorite sequences. The real estate guy. I like that actor. I want to see more of that actor. You know, well, I want to see more of him.
I'm going to say, as a standout, the runts, which they're called runts, the three kids.
Oh, man, when the fucking phone keeps ringing and it was ringing off one of the guy's mobile phones. Man. Oh, no, that was heartbreaking.
It's that scene where he picks up their handset and the cord comes off. And it's just like...
It surprised me,
and the phone is still ringing. The phone is still ringing.
Because they were taking the piss out of him from the beginning. Like, they got him to the...
Yeah.
To our listeners, don't you think that we're spoiling this movie for you?
No.
We kind of are, but we're not, really.
It's an experience.
It's a trippy experience. You need to watch. If you like Mandy, fucking watch this.
Yeah.
I need to watch this.
Like, you invoked what I consider a seminal good film with Nicolas Cage in it in the past decade. And I don't... Well,
don't fucking go there yet, because this is ratings territory. We're approaching it, but listen.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole host of actors in this, and the 5 that I picked out, I looked at their IMDb, and of course, they are actually mainstayers. They are people who have been in a lot of Australian TV. Some of them are in Home and Away, so they're all East Coast actors. Nicholas Kassam, who plays the bum, who is also known as Nick Kassam, he's been in a lot of Home and Away. Some of them have also been in Underbelly, which is a big Victorian show. And it is, you know, those are the actors who stand out the most in this. And I hate to say it, like, I didn't really care for the barista. I didn't really care for some of the other guys. The cop was okay.
Yeah, but you don't think I'm with you, right? You don't really need to, because the centerpieces of this movie are Scully and the Surfer.
Yeah.
But there
are key elements. Like, for instance, the guy who plays the cop.
The cop is fantastic.
Yeah.
I liked his performance. I did like his performance.
He sent in one tape, didn't expect to get the role, and got it straight off it because it was just exactly what they wanted.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, the edit of this movie as well was actually quite clever as well. Because there's bits that you could see that ended up on the cutting floor, and you're giving just a hint. When the cop goes down to the beach... There's two bits. You get two bits. The movie hits you twice with it, or three times, in which he kneels.
Yeah.
Mm. He kneels to the... And it doesn't want to show you the full thing, the full ritualistic nature of it yet. Mm. So you get like for a second, you see him kneeling. But it's there. And I think, obviously, that he does it twice on approach. And then when he gets to the steps, right to the entrance of the hut. Guys, this movie, by the way... reminded me of something else that I actually didn't like. Because we mentioned Mandy, and then we're going into Lovecraft territory of cosmic horror. This movie kind of has the same setup in its setting to another movie called Glorious.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't seen
it. And actually, the setup of Glorious and the... Because this is almost like fish in a barrel. Actually, if anything, it's the same setting. And here, like, I was glad to read that the parking lot is overlooking that beach.
Yeah.
That's rare, yeah. Man. That's good. Well,
it's a diamond dozen in Australia, though.
Yeah, but it's also working around the same location, which a lot of people, Hollywood doesn't do that.
No.
They just fucking move somewhere else. Here, that's dedication. I'm going to make it work. This is a question of I'm making it work. But in Glorious, you get the same setup.
Mm.
I don't know if you... Okay, to our listeners, Glorious, you don't need to really watch it. It was a disappointment because it was way too ambitious in its theme and its premise. Because anything resembling Lovecraft, it's hard to do, man. Cosmic horror, it's very hard to do. It's so abstract. Just like this movie, that it's full of abstractions. And it works. Glorious didn't for me. But Glorious is an actor that is extremely underrated, that it's also Australian, and that you may know because of True Blood. He played, his name is Ryan Quanten. I think that's how you pronounce it. He played the jock. He played Suki's brother, I think. In True Blood. He's the protagonist of Glorious. And it's the same premise. There's around that toilet and being stuck in one spot and spiraling into madness.
And trying to use resources around you as much as possible.
Absolutely. Dude, when he's just... And also the commitment of the protagonist doing shit that really gets you to suspend disbelief wouldn't have worked. And I'll say this with total confidence. This movie would have not worked without Nicolas Cage. I'm sorry, it wouldn't have. Because it's going against human nature, right? When he's drinking the water that is not potable, right? You can only see Nicolas Cage going, oh, he's taking a sip of water.
But anybody else? It's not just that. It's the can on the floor.
Yeah.
But it's also the little Nicolas Cage things. Because there's an entire story about
Before you get to the story, dude, when he gets bitten by the rat, the way he slams the rat against the door, that's pure fucking comedy, mate. I adore... You can put this man in anything. The movie would be shit, but his performance will... We're going to have to do Ghost Rider, dude.
We can have to
do it today. I want to watch Ghost Rider today.
No.
It's Ghost Rider. No,
let's just not do that.
That's when he started, when he created the new term for his acting. It was the first time that with the press he said that the quality, what is it, shamanism? It was the first time in interviews he was saying that that's his way of acting, is shamanistic. Never used that term before, but that's how he explained it for Ghost Rider.
So there's a story on set about the rats. They paid a lot of money for that prop, the second prop, the one which was put on the floor. So he picked it up and put it in his pocket, and then like the art department were trying to get that rat back basically into the box because it was an expensive prop. And he went, no, I feel that the rat now is with me. It's part of me. It's an essence of me. And then he spent the rest of the scenes basically with the art department trying to get the rat back, and the tail hanging out of his pocket, and keeping it into his pocket. And it plays off because of that one section with Eat the Rat. That is unscripted. And it's pure Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
So good.
It got a round of laughter, and they just went, yeah, we're keeping that. We're keeping also, that in there.
To use that as a sort of sustenance and then as a fucking finishing move, it's just only Nicolas Cage could do this, and it comes out of nowhere, and when it does, you'll just fucking go, yeah! Like, fuck. Now, I am not shitting you to our listeners. I promise you, all right? Maybe we'll start with Patreon. Okay, when we start the Patreon for the show, and I hope we're enriching your lives somehow, because this podcast enriches ours, all right?
Oh my God, it's so
for our
so
Patreon,
does.
Our Patreon supporters, we will release the video version of this podcast. So whenever there's a visual cue to something, you'll know exactly what it is. So this is a section of the show, which is Theater of the Mind. The guys don't know what the fuck I'm about to show them. Maybe Steve does. This has happened the day we watched this movie. Myself and Anne are ferret owners. Yes, we're that fucking weird. And one of our ferrets, Eric, had to go to the vet. This is a couple of hours before, 3 or 4 hours before we watched this movie. Now, Anna is a really good ferret mother, or a ferret parent. So whenever we put this our pets through trials and tribulations along the lines of taking them to the vet, because no pet has ever enjoyed that, we need to reward them. One of our pet has an obsession for toys that he can chew on and things, just like many pets do. And Anna bought Eric a toy. And I swear to you, this was a reason for me and Anna to laugh endlessly whenever we saw the rat on screen watching the surfer. Because 3 to 4 hours prior to watching this movie, Anna purchased this.
Oh, dear.
Now, what am I showing to the camera, guys?
You're showing a stuffed rat toy. Which is about the size of a ferret, pretty much.
And it looks exactly, doesn't look exactly like the fucking prop in the movie.
Well, talking about great shots in this movie, I loved all the Australian animals. And I know they were meant to be like the weird, like more othering. The echidnas, oh my God, those echidna shots
echidna
were
sequence,
beautiful.
Because the echidna sequence is when it's digging. Mm. Into the ground, like the editing goes back to him digging through the trash.
Yeah.
The lizard that is shown. Can anyone look that up? Because there's a particular all the fauna that is used in this movie is. But, that's when you see a taste of Australia. That's why people may get misled. I still think that this movie is not trying to be a representation of Australia in any shape or form. Okay.
I'm going to say one thing here. When we hear the kookaburra. Both me and Mary went, kookaburra!
But it feels like... Dude, in Australia, you wake up to these fucking birds, man.
Yeah,
in the city.
Like,
it's so loud.
Even, like, I live next to the bush. Forest area, whatever they call the bush over here. I live right next to the bush every single day. I wake up to kookaburras, and it's just so loud here. Such a loud country.
Yeah.
Every animal.
Isn't that unusual?
And deadly.
Know, like, it could be a rooster in other parts of the world, but in Australia, like even in Sydney, when we were living in Newtown, you would wake up to them cackling in the morning. Like, yeah. But in this one, it's derision.
Yeah.
And the first time you hear the kookaburra taking the piss out of him is when the water's gone. That's it. The water source is gone because now it's smeared in fucking dog shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And they start up and there's more of them. I'm not sure what the lizard was. I think. Was it orange looking? I can't remember.
I can't remember.
You know what? I'll do a quick search on Google. Australian lizards.
While you're doing that search, the snake which was featured in the movie did actually bite Nicolas Cage.
Now, that snake, I'm hoping it's like sort of the fake version. There's quite a few snakes who, like, there's a coral snake and there's a red belly. If you meet a red belly snake, that red belly snake will kill you.
Yeah.
Whereas the coral snake, which is similar markings, I think there's a slight oranger look to them. They're okay. And that's one of the funnest things about Australia. No matter what animal you're looking at, you're sort of like, I'm going to Google search it.
Yeah. Is that spider going to kill me?
I have mantises that visit my garden all the time. And the first time I saw one, I was amazed by it. And then it gave me a look. And then I walked away.
Okay.
I don't know if a mantis can actually harm me or scratch me up or anything, but they're so beautiful. They walk so amazingly. And then they give you this very, very intense stare. And you're like, oh, I need to get this away from the kids. Move it away. Move it away. Into the bush.
Oh,
I found it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Go for it.
It's a blue tongue skink.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's kind of cute. I want it as a pet. When I saw it. And the echidna was amazing.
The echidna is amazing.
But it's just how it splices through that it's perfect. Like, one thing that I was super impressed by, like, I don't know why, but it worked, but it didn't hit me that is the there are a couple of attempts here to I think it wasn't heavy-handed. It didn't feel heavy-handed, but I know why they were there. And it's a matter of inclusion, and it's necessary as well. Like, I like the interaction. First of all, she's essential for the narrative of this movie. That's another one of the things that without her, I would have walked away. Like, you need the photographer. You need the Aborigine girl as a photographer who's decided to very adventurously change her life. And that's another message in the movie as well.
Yeah.
Like, that interaction is very important because at one point she says something with that kind of politeness that is still trying to get a very important message across. She says, that's a very long time to do something you don't want to do. You know, and because at the end of the day, you could see that this is a man in the thrives of a midlife crisis. And, you know, like I said earlier, he's a product of trauma, something that has never been resolved. If anything, that's this movie is a very positive message, which is you make a break for it. You know, survival itself, there's it's like you said, man, the more we talk about this movie, the more I don't see myself forgetting this. This is not a movie that if someone has watched from beginning to end, it's like, Steve, that fucking thing that you do, which is, oh, I've seen this. This one, you've seen this one.
I've seen
it. You remember this one, right?
Someone else who will remember this one.
Spader, welcome. Mr. Spader. Oh,
how are you doing, guys? I've been hearing this conversation, and it's a shame it's not the conversation. But this guy, Nick Star 18, he gave it a 10 out of 10. He said, "Crazy Cage, but good Crazy Cage. Some movies feel a little phoned in, not this one. The commitment is there. Plus, the movie is Australian in the best way, too. Really reflective vibes, minus the insanity. Have you seen Julian McMahon in anything since the MF Doom cosplay? So it's good to see him again, too. But this, you won't go bonkers, but you will experience everything shown. Through our locals are usually extremely welcoming. So thank you, Nickstar18, June 16th, 2025. But a one-star review,
by from
Pensacola Computer, June 8th, 2025.
You fucking piece of shit.
Hey, let's listen to him. He might have a point. I don't think he does, but let's have a look. How in the world is this movie a 6.4 rating? This has got to be a mistake. This is the worst Nicolas Cage movie I have seen in probably 20 years or so. It had, up until this point, been a pretty decent role of a pretty good films lately, but this one could be his worst movie to date. This movie reminds me of Nicolas Cage films from about 20 years ago when all he made was garbage B movies, except this one is probably even worse than all of those. This movie probably could have been 5 minutes long. You've got all important parts of the film. That's how much happens in an hour and 40-minute abomination. 1 out of 10, absolutely incredibly bad. Pensacola Computer, June 8th, 2025.
I hope you never get laid, you sack of shit.
thank you, Mr. Spader.
To every single woman living in Pensacola,
hey,
please.
Hey, we all know please. That I get
laid. Right, guys. We have spoiled this movie enough.
Yes, we have.
I highly recommend this movie.
Okay.
I highly recommend this movie also.
I think maybe not.
Oh, you fucking contrarian.
So,
anyway, write your ratings down because it is ratings time.
It is ratings time. All right, I'll go first. I don't know what I was expecting from this film, and I really was looking for something that the film was offering more than I felt like it did. I think it's a beautiful film. I think the acting's great. Especially from its lead roles. But there's something about the unreliable narrator areas that I felt could have been more done in a more narrative way. I felt a little bit disjointed throughout it, which is fine. I love films that are disjointed, but this one just wasn't hitting the mark for me. And as I always say, if I'm probably not going to see the film again, I'm going to give it less than 5. So this is a good film. This is a good film. I am not watching this film ever again. Hence, my score is 4.5. 4.5 bums pretending to be my dad on the beach.
Okay, so after watching this movie, I would have rated it a 6. But with sitting down and thinking about the movie over the last couple of days and how it affected me, it's a film which affected me. So any given time that you have a movie which does kind of sinks its claws into you and basically turns around and says, you need to like rewatch this at some other point. You need to understand that this gave me a reaction. It was a negative reaction while watching it, but the fact that if it's still with me is something which I find strong in a movie. And it is going to be rewatched. It's probably going to be rewatched at Umba's at some point. So we can just go, ooh! But I'm going to give it 7.5 bullets in a stub nose gun.
Fuck.
You didn't talk about the gun, man.
You have to talk about the gun.
I just did.
You motherfucker. You see what he did? You see how he put it right in there, man?
Yeah.
What is the gun?
It's a Colt, and it's a
Do you want to take your fucking time on it?
I'm not going to take it. I don't want to fucking say too much about it. It's a piece of shit.
Are you sure it's a Colt?
Yeah, it's a Colt.
Okay.
And it's 7.5. It's a stub nose. 45.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. This movie is, first of all, it's mental that Ricky gave it a 4.5 when he gave 7.5 to fucking Hot Shots Part 3. But that's a different story.
I did. I will watch that again.
Yes, you did. And I told you that I would throw this at you any chance I got.
You can do. I'm the one who picked the best film that we've seen so far on the podcast.
Oh, my God. Shame on me for fucking allowing this behavior. Unmute your microphone. I want people to hear you cackle, you piece of shit.
No.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Don't need you muted.
That's
I
the
hear
cackle
you.
We're looking for.
Now.
Put B up a little bit more.
I gave this movie a 7.5, unusually. And I'll tell you why. I said it earlier. It's not easy. It's not easy to do, at least to me, okay, what this movie has done. The worst thing a movie can do is to force you to suspend disbelief without earning that right. And this movie somehow got to do that. Now, was it intentional? Is it a magic trick? Is it lightning in a bottle? I think it is. I think it's a happy accident. Like Bob Ross would say, this movie's a happy, well, not happy, but it's traumatic. It's a traumatic accident. And would this work at all without the electric presence of the protagonist and its antagonist? No. So it is performance driven. There is even a sequence that it's the highlight of this movie for me, and we didn't mention it, and that's why it's getting a 7.5. It is the truce. There is a moment in which Scully offers two burgers and a beer. Something as trivial as a burger and a beer becomes the truce moment of this movie. It's like, and it's such a simple, trivialistic little juxtaposition for a scene, and it can only work with two good actors.
Yeah.
So I really hope that Julian McMahon we get to see more of this guy. He's 56, 57. He looks younger in this as well. There's a kind of electricity emanating from this villain because he is a villain. And so, but it's not clear cut. And that's what I like. I like the ambiguous kind of blur lines of this movie that are representative of this movie, because that is the very thing that drives what it condemns, which is the rise of all these ideologies that are taking the place of older institutions like religion and politics. So, is this movie linear? Is it non-linear? Is it disjointed? Is it janky? It is, actually. It is quite janky. It's not. But the fact is that somehow there's a magical aura around it that will keep your attention. And these days, that's gold. That is gold dust. We live in an age in which people get easily distracted, including myself. Doesn't matter how much previous training you had. But come on, the newer generation is living on a dopamine drip feed, and this movie somehow gets you to fucking stay with it. it's almost Lynchian in the way it comes across at times. It has no business in being something worth talking about and something that demands and earns your 90 minutes. So it is a 7.5 at Rats, used as a Mortal Kombat finisher move.
Nice.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This was Steve.
This is Ricky.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of. Think twice.